So this is, as Syl mentioned, meant to be very informal, and thank you for coming. And so meant to be informal, feel free to ask questions and kind of we can generate a discussion if you guys have questions. As Syl mentioned, I am an assistant professor of public health and medicine at Cornell Medical School, and kind of my goal in, I guess, in my career, in my life, is to improve the way we deliver healthcare. And I do that by doing research, and also as a practicing internist. So I do try to translate my research into clinical care, but I'm also kind of interested in also educating the public on how they can get the best healthcare they can. So I do that through research as my mechanism, and I have this great team. Jamie is our research coordinator. There's a whole group of us of health economists and physician researchers that do work in how we do solving problems on how we deliver healthcare in the U.S. And so this talk is based on a study that we did in over the course of the past 2 years, actually, and that was recently published in the journal Health Affairs in August. So this is really kind of to give you a glimpse of what we do in our world of research. But I think it actually touches on an area that's really interesting, really hot in the kind of healthcare delivery world. And I think we've been able to kind of garner what's good about electronic communication and this new way of delivering care to patients, but also have identified a lot of challenges of how you actually move this forward in the future. So this is a picture of Cornell Medical School. It looks so kind of new and exciting and lots of lights everywhere. But what's interesting is this is a picture by Norman Rockwell from the early 20th century. And it's kind of what I think many of us think of the doctor-patient encounter, that a patient goes into their doctor's office. I don't see pediatric patients, but this doctor's office looks exactly like my doctor's office. You know, we have the stethoscope, we have the diplomas on the wall, we have the patient sitting there, the doctor examining him, this kind of bench, that uncomfortable bench that we always have to sit on. But this is how we practiced medicine hundreds of years ago, and how we still practice medicine today. And I would say the one thing that is very different about how we practice medicine today is that it's much crazier. You know, you look back at this picture, and I wish my practice was like this, that I had time to kind of sit on the bench and spend time with my patients. But my practice is like this. I actually was seeing patients yesterday, and for some kind of computer glitch, got sort of double booked, and I literally felt like a chicken with my head cut off, running around from exam room to exam room to try and see all the patients in the time that I had allotted for them. I think some of that has to do with how, you know, changes in how we pay for healthcare, reimbursement rates, expectations of how much you're supposed to get done in a day. And this is how outpatient medicine is practiced. It's crazy and it's busy and it's kind of at a much more harried pace. This is a slide that I love to kind of, was given to me by a colleague. But when you're in that kind of the throes of practicing medicine, it's very hard to kind of take a step back and say, how would I actually make this better and deliver healthcare better? So this is from the Winnie the Pooh book. And it says, here is Edward Bear coming down the stairs, bump, 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 on the back of his head behind Christopher Robin. It is, as far as he knows, the only way of coming downstairs, but sometimes he feels that there really is another way, if only he could stop bumping for a moment and think of it. And I think that captures what many doctors feel, that we all feel kind of harried. I think many patients feel this way too, that there has to be a better way to deliver it. As Syl said, you know, I wish I could Skype with my doctor, but that's not how we structure healthcare. So my group and I have been very lucky to have a chance to kind of have time to say, let's step away from all the bumping of healthcare delivery and think about how we can actually deliver things better. So one way that I think we can deliver it, and I I put my phone somewhere. Is, you know, I think one thing that is actually going to really transform healthcare is something like this. So I assume everyone in this room has something like this in their pocket, an iPhone, a BlackBerry, an iPad, a laptop. And I think about how I spend my days, and I'm unfortunately or fortunately tethered to this thing, and this is how I spend much of my time, is emailing with other people, texting with other people, looking up things on the internet, just spending a lot of time communicating and learning and getting information all electronically. And that is how we all spend our time. I think in journalism and in any industry that you're in, that's how you spend your time. And if we're all spending our time, if patients and doctors too are spending their time on computers all the time, there has to be a way to maybe tap into that, the fact that we are all connected all the time. And so I'm gonna start by telling you a few examples of real patients that I take care of, and kind of how we have been able to use what is a secure messaging system through our electronic health record to really deliver what traditionally has been delivered when patients come into the office. So this is a patient, a young woman who emailed me through our secure messaging system with symptoms that were consistent with a urinary tract infection. I will say I actually have a little more time to even, because I'm kind of on the computer all the time, I was able to get that message really quickly and didn't kind of push it off till the end of the day. Got that message, I emailed her back and said, you know, do you have any of these warning signs? She said no, and then I electronically prescribed an antibiotic for her. And this was a Friday afternoon before a weekend. If this had not happened, she might not have gotten treatment or might have had to go like the emergency room because it was a Friday afternoon. So quickly, it took from noon to four, this whole encounter was finished, but between the two of us, it took us probably about 5 to 10 minutes to figure everything out and get everything kind of prescribed and solved. So it took, you know, over a course of a few hours, it took us really just a few minutes to kind of solve this problem for her. And then this is another example of a patient. So that's kind of an acute example. A patient has a problem. They want to get care very quickly. Many of us feel that a lot of that care doesn't need to involve coming into the doctor's office to get that solved. This is a case of someone who has a chronic medical condition. And chronic medical conditions are costing our country millions and millions of dollars. We're having more and more chronic medical conditions. They're kind of plugging up our primary healthcare system. Is there a way to actually manage chronic medical conditions more efficiently without having to bring patients in all the time? So this is a patient, she's in her 60s. She's very well educated. She came into my office for kind of a routine checkup and her blood pressure was elevated. She has a home blood pressure kit that looks sort of like this on her wrist. You can check her blood pressures. And she said, well, you know, can I just send you a log of my blood pressures? And I said, sure, send me a log, keep a record, and in 2 weeks, send me what it's been at home. And that's what she did. And she actually gave me more data, better data than I could actually get in the office. If she had come in, I would get one blood pressure reading. I ended up getting 14 blood pressure readings from her. Maybe even more because she checked it multiple times a day. I mean, she was really on top of it. She sent me all of these readings, all through our secure messaging system. And 2 weeks later, I said, look, your blood pressure's high. Why don't we double the dose of one of your medications? She never came in to see me. I just managed it like that. Really effective, really easy for her, really easy for me. And then this is kind of the last scenario that I actually really think can actually change the doctor-patient relationship in some ways. For any practicing doctor, we all know what a difficult patient is. And you probably can imagine what a difficult patient is. We all have difficult patients. You know, they're the patients that come in with a laundry list of problems, who kind of are demanding things, who are never really satisfied with what you do in the office. Especially, you know, I have a few patients, and the example I'm using is one of them where I see her on the schedule and I kind of cringe because I just know it's going to be we're gonna have a hard visit and I'm gonna kind of leave dissatisfied. She's gonna leave dissatisfied. And so I always kind of prep myself when I see her on my schedule. So, you know, probably about a year ago, she finally signed on to our secure messaging system. We had one of those typical visits where she left unhappy. I was very unhappy with the encounter. I was concerned about actually giving her email access to me because I was worried that she might just barrage me with emails, which did happen. So she started sending me all these messages, and I thought, oh gosh, I'm going to pull out my hair. I can't respond to all these messages. But I slowly answer them, and you know, every day I would answer another question that she had, and we would kind of talk, have these email conversations, and then they started to slow down. So she had a barrage of emails, then slowing down. But what was great is a month later, she came in for her regular checkup, and a lot of the little things that were really bothering her that just took up time in the office but didn't really need to take up time were solved prior to her coming in. And so we were able to kind of do a physical exam, move on to next steps, and really solve many of the little things that were bothering her. And so she and I, it has transformed the way we communicate. She still comes into the office pretty regularly for her chronic medical conditions, but all the things that made it difficult to care for her, I wouldn't say are completely gone, but are so much better because we now have this kind of conversation going on between our visits that doesn't actually take me so much time. You know, if I had to pick up the phone and call her constantly, that would be much more time on my back. So these are my examples of kind of why I think email, electronic communication, mobile devices can actually transform how we deliver healthcare. And I think there's other people that agree with me. This is from a report by the Institute of Medicine in 2001 called Crossing the Quality Chasm. And one of the things that the Institute of Medicine, which is a large kind of nonprofit body that gives recommendations about how we deliver healthcare, what they recommended is that patients should receive care whenever they need it, in many forms, not just in face-to-face visits, and the healthcare system has to be responsive to them 24 hours a day. That means providing care through the internet, through telephone, and through other means. But unfortunately, when you look at national data, this is from a national survey of physicians that is done every single year. The most recent data that's been published is actually from 2008, but I did some analysis and looked at some 2009 data. When you look at the numbers, if you look at the y-axis over there, it goes up to 10. That just means 10%. It doesn't mean 100%, so it's a little shortened. But basically, less than 10% of outpatient physicians do electronic consultations with their patients. So a very small percentage of doctors are actually emailing, doing clinical care through electronic means. And so this is almost 10 years after the Institute of Medicine has recommended that we start looking at new ways to deliver care, but most physicians in the U.S. are not delivering care that way. But the good news is that there have been reports in the medical literature that there are medical groups that are actually trying to change how we deliver care and use email and electronic communication more. One of them is a group called Greenfield Health, which is up in Oregon, has really kind of tried to eliminate many of the visits that they have in the office. One of them, this kind of return on investment slide is by an organization called Group Health, which is up in Washington State, and which I'll talk about a little more as we go on. And then this one right here is kind of just looking at trends in email encounters at Kaiser Permanente, which is a large HMO this one is actually one that is in Colorado, and we'll talk about them also in a few minutes. So there seem to be some kind of progressive organizations, but physician groups that are trying to change things. And so what we wanted to do was actually learn more about what those groups were doing. So we did, with a lot of Jamie's help, we did what's called a qualitative study. I don't know if anyone is familiar with qualitative research, but it's the it's kind of not numbers. We are trying to kind of explore ideas, explore concepts, understand themes. And we did that by interviewing a number of physician leaders, a number of frontline physicians who are actually practicing in all these organizations. So we did over 50 interviews of leaders in healthcare organizations and frontline physicians. We did some interviews of some health plans to really kind of get a sense of how are people doing this and getting these, you know, changing face-to-face visits to electronic visits. And so what we wanted to do is actually look at three research questions. So, you know, when we talk to these people, how do you actually change medical care from a face-to-face visit to something that's more virtual? And what did you actually have to do? Did you have to change the physician's schedule? Did you have to change the way they were paid? What do you do to actually get that done? And then what was the effect of it? You know, did patients like it? Was there an effect? Did physicians like it? And was it safe? There were, you know, all sorts of questions about whether this is actually, you know, what is the effect of actually changing this? And then the third one was, what barriers did you have to overcome to actually do this kind of transformation? So we focused on six medical groups, and these are the six medical groups. As I mentioned earlier, we captured Kaiser Permanente, which is a big HMO, a healthcare maintenance organization in Colorado. And the way Kaiser is paid is for every patient, they get a fixed dollar amount. So it's not like most doctors. So most doctors get paid. If you come in for a visit, you get paid for that visit. If you do an EKG, you get paid for that EKG. And at Kaiser and also at Group Health, which is at the bottom there, they get paid a fixed amount for a patient. So to take care of your health, they will say, we'll give you X number of dollars, just take care of that patient. And so they're paid very differently than most doctors' offices. So Group Health is the other one that's paid like that, and what Group Health is up in Washington State. So these two organizations are paid what's called a capitated payment model. The second organization is up in Alaska, actually, up in Anchorage. It's called South Central Foundation. And they're paid kind of in a normal fee-for-service way, but they also get a lot of government subsidies because they care for an underserved population. They care for a huge population in Alaska that is very rural, and people, you know, end up having to drive hours to get to their clinic. So they kind of have a different incentive because they're caring for a different population. The third group is a group called Palo Alto Medical Foundation. And Palo Alto is like any medical group. It actually didn't have anything that was so unusual, but it's in Palo Alto, California, so that's why it's called Palo Alto Medical Group. And Palo Alto Medical Group has a lot of market pressures because there's a big presence by Kaiser in the area. So they have to compete, they're paid very differently, but they have to compete against the Kaiser, which is the big HMO that's in the area. And then the fourth one is called Fairview Medical Group, which is up in Minnesota. And Fairview is also kind of a standard kind of healthcare group. They're paid the way most doctors are paid, by visits, and they care for a large population in Minnesota. And then the last one is called Eisenhower Medical Group. This is down in San Diego, and it's a primary care group. It's part of a larger hospital, but there's a small primary care group that is paid, and I'm kind of bringing back payment because I think that's a big barrier, and I'll talk about that a little later. But they're paid kind of normally. You get fee for service, so you go to see the doctor gets paid, but they also charge what's called a retainer fee, so they charge about $500 a year for you to be part of that practice. So those are the six organizations that we looked at. Just remove my other slide, but I'll tell you a little bit about how they structured things. So all of these groups had an electronic portal or a secure emailing system, so they could communicate with patients securely without privacy concerns, and they use them in very different ways. So Kaiser Permanente in Colorado had a secure messaging service, but what they did was they changed the way the schedules of physicians. So in an hour, most physicians would see three patients, three 20-minute visits in 1 hour. What Kaiser did was they said, let's give you two 20-minute visits and then 20 minutes to do virtual care, however you want to do it. And so they've tried to kind of change, give people time to actually do all this care. Group Health did something similar. They gave doctors an hour a day off their schedule to actually deal with all of the email communications that were coming in. Eisenhower gave doctors kind of any, they could do whatever they wanted. You know, they could see no patients a day if they wanted to just communicate electronically. And what they told us is about two-thirds of their care is delivered through email messaging. Most of what they do is through email messaging. They have this interesting population in San Diego of, they call them sunbirds, that are there in the wintertime and leave during the summer. And so they have a lot of patients who will just email them from wherever they are in the summertime and say, I'm having this problem, what can I do about it? And they manage a lot of that through email. South Central did something that they called scrubbing, which was they would go through the schedule and contact patients and say, you know, tell me what's going on. Do you really need to come in? And they would remove patients that they felt didn't need to come in, which was interesting because, as I said, they have patients driving 2 hours a day. And one person said to us, it's such a waste of time for someone to come in for a cold when I could just manage it by talking to them. Either by telephone or email. And then the last one was Fairview actually had a system that was a formal system called an e-visit system, and they used a computer program called Zipnosis, where patients could log in and put in a complaint, and a nurse practitioner would get that information and then figure out what to do and then email them back. And they actually had to pay for that if you wanted to do an e-visit, but some insurance companies actually covered it. So it was a formal program that said, you know, if you have a problem, maybe we can do it by an e-visit. If not, then we'll have you come in. And so what we learned was that, I'm going to just talk a little bit about what we learned from the interviews and just briefly go through things. As you can all imagine, patients love this. So patients love the fact that they don't have to come in when it's not necessary. They don't have to take a half a day off of work. They don't have to get a babysitter. And they were just really happy with it. You know, patients love it. One person said they feel really satisfied to have access to their doctor through email, which is very rare. You know, when you normally call up the doctor's office, you have to get through like walls and walls to actually get in touch with your doctor. So people were satisfied to almost feel like they had a direct connection with their doctor. And it really improved access to care. So one person, again, said that same thing. They feel like they had this incredible access to their physician that they didn't have before. They feel like they have a direct line of communication. The second quote is actually from a woman out at Eisenhower down in San Diego who was telling me about just some of her experiences. She had a patient whose husband died unexpectedly and was really struggling with it. You know, you can't really call up your doctor at 3 o'clock in the morning when you can't sleep, or, you know, you could, but they're not going to be happy about it. Her doctor, who would get it when she started her office hours. But that was like very, very therapeutic for her to be able to email her doctor and then feel like she had that support from her doctor. So she really thought that it was a very successful thing, that she said she would never have dreamt that this would be a good thing, but it actually really was. And then I love this quote because I'm actually a mother, and so I sympathize with any mother who has to take their kid in to go to the doctor. But there was a group up in Minnesota who said that young mothers are the largest users because it gives them easy access to care. So, you know, no babysitters, no dragging your child to the doctor. It's an easy way for people to get accessible care. The other kind of positive thing we heard was that it takes very little time. So I mentioned that patient who had the urinary tract infection. She may have come in, you know, spent probably 30 minutes in my office. I would have spent however long it would take to kind of get things organized for her. When I go back to that slide, it took me like 5 minutes to manage things. It was all electronically at times that were convenient for us. So, you know, people said it takes 1 minute or less of my time to email my patients. Another person said, you know, he often will have people either call or come into the office because they read something in the news. He was able to just respond at a time that was actually convenient for him. So it actually helped him be more efficient, but get back to his patients. But one of the things that we found that was negative is that it can create a lot more work for doctors. And so this came through many, many times in our interviews. One leader at an organization said email takes little time, but they add up. And one day, I've been in touch with 60 of my patients, 10 in person and 50 through email. So that's, you know, that's a lot of work that we weren't doing before. We were not emailing 50 people during the day. Another person said, and this probably goes for every single industry, it feels like you're never, you know, you guys are writers, like, it feels like you're never done, right? There's this feeling of you always have more emails to check. You can't leave the office at the end of the day because at the end of the day you have to check your emails, and maybe that evening you have to check your emails. So it can take a psychological toll of never feeling like you're done. And then, you know, someone who's a number of kind of real frontline doctors who are seeing patients every day who said it's allowed us to work all the time. You know, that's how it feels, is that we're working all the time. And even people who had changes in their schedule said everything creeps into all free time that they have. So that was the real negative thing that came out from our interviews. And then one of the barriers I think that came out was that it isn't necessarily for every patient. I'm used to using my internet, using my email, but for older patients who get a lot of care, you know, who are really the users of our healthcare system, it might actually not be that easy for them to use email and electronic communication. So for older patients, it's a whole different world. Some patients just are used to that model. They want to come in and they want to have that physical doctor-patient relationship of actually being seen by their doctor. One person said that what they had to do was actually, they had kind of a little computer lab in their office where they taught older patients how to use the system. They had staff that was there to really help them get used to the system so they could use it. So that's one barrier. I think the other barrier is that how we pay for healthcare. So this, we don't pay 5 cents for psychiatric help anymore, but this is, you know, we're used to paying for healthcare based on almost every model of payment for healthcare is you go in, you get a service, you get the doctor's office gets paid, and none of this in general is compensated care. So all of those cases I told you about, I could have had those patients come in and I could have managed them in the office and I would have billed for it and I would have gotten paid for it. All the care that I delivered, the blood pressure medication changes, the urinary tract infection, I got paid $0. And I'm lucky because I'm in a faculty practice and I don't see patients that frequently. So it doesn't matter that much. But if you're in a doc, you know, if you're, this is your livelihood and this is how you get paid, if you're not paid for all of this care, it's going to be really hard to change a model and change people's behavior. The good news is that there's a lot of technology that I think is really interesting and really exciting. And if we can get over those barriers about payment and get over the barriers of culture change, that there's a lot of exciting things. So these are just two examples of really cool, interesting technology. One is called Instant Medical History, which is kind of almost like an online survey that you fill out. And a few of the groups were using this. So if you were going to get an e-visit by your doctor, you'd fill this all out and it would kind of get sent to your doctor in a way that's really easy to comprehend for the doctor and captures all the information that they probably need. So that's called Instant Medical History. This is a company, it's a startup called TapTrack, which allows you, anyway, you can kind of track anything you want, but it allows you to track things. So if you want to track whether you whether you took your medications. If you have a patient who isn't maybe that compliant with their medications, you can use this, and it then it can be fed into the doctor's office. There's still kind of questions about how that actually happens and whether it'll be easily usable on the doctor's end, but TapTrack's an interesting kind of getting all that data that happens outside of the visit, blood pressures, heart rates, all sorts of things that you can track. And then the other thing that I think is probably putting on a lot of pressure, perhaps, or will put on pressure for doctors and doctors' offices, are a whole slew of online doctoring companies. So these are just three examples. I Googled this the other night, and these are a few that came up. So these are all companies where you can go online and you can pay a fee, put your credit card in, and you put your symptoms in, and there's a doctor somewhere on the other end that that manages something. So you have a cough, you want to get some medical advice, you can go onto one of these services. They're staffed by doctors, so not necessarily your own doctor. So whether that, I don't know if patients will in the future have concerns about that, but they're really springing up all over the place. And so this may be kind of a market pressure that pushes healthcare in another direction also. Lots of things that are going on. And I'm just gonna end with a quote about that I really love, because I think it kind of, medicine is very hard to change, and it's just like many industries, but I think even more, it changes at glacial paces. But I think this is a great quote. It is not the strongest of the species that survives, nor the most intelligent that survives. It is the one that is most adaptable to change. So that's where I'll end the presentation, and I'm happy to chat and talk about questions. And as Syl mentioned, I know there's other healthcare reform things that are going on in the upcoming days, so I'm happy to chat about that too if anyone wants to. Okay, sure.
I'm trying to play devil's advocate.
So, okay.
Maybe time zone, like your first patient, and typically for me, it's Friday 8 p.m. or Saturday morning.
Right.
When you have a throat that is like this, and I know anything about something, I even know which one I need because I have a throat that I can get to anybody. So that sounds like an incredible solution to so many problems. But then, of course, it introduces other problems. Well, first of all, how do they know that the patients who are emailing are describing their symptoms correctly? There's so many symptoms that can mask other symptoms
right. That
have nothing to do with like the actual problem they might be having. It can be something totally different.
Right.
How are we gonna deal with that? What if the doctors? What if the doctor's starting something that the patient is allergic to, and the patient dies?
Right. Okay. So a few things. So we were this is something that came up when I talked to other doctors about it. Safety is definitely a concern. How do you know that I can't do that over email? That's not safe. From our interviews, not one of the organizations had an unsafe experience using it. I didn't put the quotes up, but we asked very specifically, were you concerned about did anything bad happen by changing things and not having the patient come in? Most places, almost every place, had some sort of language on their website that said don't use this for emergency conditions. You definitely don't want a patient emailing you about chest pain when it could be a heart attack. There are conditions that, and you have to kind of use patients' judgment on that, even a patient calling about that, patients have to have judgment about use their judgment about what's urgent and really can't wait, because all of these websites, you're not going to get an immediate response. Often they'll say we have within 24 hours you will hear from someone from our practice. In terms of getting at symptoms, so instant medical history seem to have a really good way at getting at symptoms and kind of helping you narrow down and asking questions about it. But in the places that didn't use instant medical history, I think many of them would kind of have a little bit of a back and forth. And I think all doctors know kind of warning sign symptoms to look for. There were even some practices that the staff actually had warning sign symptoms to ask about, so that it wasn't always the doctor that had to ask, but sometimes a staff member could look at, they had lists of things that they could ask about. We really thought there would be a lot of concerns about safety and mistakes happening, and they didn't seem to pan out as we had thought that might be. And allergies and things like that, all those things are actually now, often we will ask about that before we prescribe anything, but now with electronic medical records, a lot of that is captured already, and pharmacies have electronic records, so we have a little better, I think, control over knowing that kind of information.
And my other question is, this sounds really good. It sounds like it should be working already in larger medical centers. Like, the very first time I saw a doctor send an email to a doctor, he was referring me to, who was like 6 or 7 years ago at Tisch Medical Hospital, again, because I had a problem where they had to investigate the doctor. I had never before in Brooklyn, Queens, go to any of the boroughs. I mean, if they have some kind of an old PC that's barely working, and that's pretty much all they have. And they never email to a doctor about you. At best, they give you a referral. How do we break through this? It seems that it's such an established thing.
So that's a great question. So one thing is, I think there has been a concern about security. So I don't think any doctor necessarily feels comfortable sending you an email from their Gmail account because they're concerned about whether that's their security in that email. So electronic health records have the capacity to allow doctors and patients to communicate securely, often through they're generally web portals. That I think is going to really take off. So electronic health records, it has been, as I mentioned, things change at glacial paces. So we've had the capacity to do that for a long time, 8 years, even longer, long time to have the capacity. Did doctors' offices pick up electronic health records and start using them? No. There was no, it just wasn't a business model that worked, right? Why would I invest $50,000 in an electronic health record when it didn't change how much I got paid, when it didn't... when it was a big investment, when I didn't know whether that technology would be the same 5 years from now. And most practices in the U.S. are tiny practices. They're 1 to 2 physicians. They don't have the capacity. So in 2009, when the Obama Recovery Act was in place, part of the Recovery Act was to try to digitize healthcare. So there's been enormous, enormous progress in getting health records to doctors. So that, I think, is a barrier that we are going to see go away, that doctors will have the ability to. The question is, will they have the time, will they have the pressure, will they have the culture to actually do that? And I still think communicating among doctors is backwards. The communication that I have with my patients is actually much better than the communication I have with doctors. I don't have a. I mean, I think I don't know. I don't know what the solution is. There are doctors who I can in my system who I can message, which are great. That's really easy, and I end up referring to them because I see their notes. I can send them a quick message to say, I saw your note. What do you think? Should we do this next? If they're outside of my system, I find it really challenging. And so, if I don't personally know them, it's really hard to coordinate care. Yeah. So that's probably another thing that needs to be disrupted in some way.
I know this is something Rachel was interested in talking about, and I complained about my doctor earlier. So say I next time I see my doctor, what are some ways that I can bring up email exchanges and engage in this kind of way? Do you have any tips on how I can approach my doctor about this and some things that I can be doing to help him out? Like I see monitoring myself at home would be a big help.
Right. So I think one, asking whether they have it. Do you have a secure messaging system? So sometimes if you say, do you email your patients? I think that doctors are like, oh, I don't email my patients. You know, I'm not gonna open that floodgate of emails from my patients. But secure messaging. So if you can use that word secure messaging, that is a good way to. Can you do it through your medical record? And that's the one question you need to ask. And you should ask. Every doctor you go to see, do you secure, if this is a way you want to communicate, you should ask, do you secure message with your patients? Now in terms of blood pressure monitoring and things like that, that's another, question is, well, what kinds of things do you like me to message you about? Some doctors will not want to get 15 blood pressure readings because they won't know what to do with that information. It won't change what they're doing. So you can ask specifically what kinds of things. If I'm sick, can I email you? What kinds of things would be good for email electronic communication? So those two questions, I think.
Kind of figure out where that line is.
Yeah.
You don't want to be that patient.
Right. You don't want to be the patient who says who sends like incredible amounts of data, and your doctor isn't prepared to synthesize that data and deal with that data. I think that if you have a doctor, that's kind of a good gauge of whether that doctor is someone that you're going to be able to communicate well with. And then also this question of access to acute care. So acute care means something happens, I have a problem, I need to get help quickly. Understanding what their processes for that. So should I call for those kinds of situations? Can I email you? And what's your turnaround? So how quickly should I expect a response from you? I mentioned some of the clinical situations, but we do a lot of other communication through email. I send all, if my patient is on our secure messaging system, I send them every lab result. They get every lab result almost automatically. They can make copies of everything, so when they need to bring something to another doctor, they just print it up, or they can pull it up on their iPad. So that's all available to them, and it should be, right? It should be information that every patient should know, right? This is their health. They should have access to all the information, and they should have copies of it, be able to make, do whatever they want with that information.
Sometimes I see my doctor has that folder, and I'm thinking, can I see that?
Yeah, you can. This way, it's like it's really in your hands. And I've had patients correct me. They've said, well, you listed these problems. That resolved a few years ago. Or my allergies are not listed correctly in your computer system. So it doesn't have every single thing that we do, but it has a lot of information that we enter, and so patients know, patients can check. And I really think it puts healthcare in patients' hands, which is important, actually. And then for other logistical things, they can email about refills, they can email about appointments. So we're my practice is probably not at the phase of really changing things that dramatically, but we have the technology, and if the physician's willing to use it, it can really change the way you do things.
How about like things people can buy at home? Like I saw that device, that wrist device on the slide you have. Are there certain things you would recommend people buy for themselves if they're going to be emailing their doctor?
It depends on your condition. So I ask all my patients to have a home blood pressure kit because of this situation, they can send me a list, a log of all their blood pressures. I actually have a number of patients that have something called white coat hypertension, which means they come to the doctor's office and their blood pressure goes up. It makes them stressed out. I saw a patient yesterday who every time she comes into the office, she's 140 over 90, and that's elevated. And
yeah, you're
she,
in the hot seat,
right, right. She brings in her log and it was completely normal. And I said, well, we would probably adjust all your medications unnecessarily and maybe over-treat you for hypertension if I didn't have this information. So it depends on your med. I don't think everyone needs a blood pressure kit, but if you have hypertension, that's a nice thing to have at home. And we have more and more technology like that. We have home monitoring of blood pressure. We have home monitoring of sugar. And one of the things that I think will happen, and we have to struggle with and figure out in the healthcare system, is how do we like incorporate all that information into our medical practice? It's great that you have that information, but if no one's going to act on it, it's kind of wasted information. So that's another issue that we haven't really figured out yet. But there's definitely but lots of technology out there, and things like TapTrack and things like that are going to give us more information. But on the other side is, how do we respond to all that information?
A few questions. So for low-income patients who don't have access regularly to email as much as everyone in this room, like, I wonder if the Alaska group had that issue, or maybe I'm stereotyping rural Alaska. I mean, there are people in America who don't have
high-speed
internet.
Yeah, absolutely. Right, right.
So is there, in the places you studied, was it not an issue, though? Just the populations happened to all be emailable?
No one really mentioned it. I mean, it definitely is. Older patients came up by a few groups, and I think it just may be because those are the patients that are getting a lot of medical care.
Right.
I mean, we have actually, and that I think is a really good question. We actually have a quality improvement study going on at the hospital, at New York Hospital, trying to get older patients to use a piece of software to see what they're doing after they get discharged. And it's been incredibly difficult to enroll patients. A lot of them don't have smartphones, don't know how to download an app. You know, it's just really confusing.
Even if they do, they don't.
Right. They're like, my daughter does that all for me. So that's a really good question. And I mean, I think that's the limitation of using this. But, you know, you also think that if you can kind of shift some of the stuff that you're dealing with in a visit now, even if it's not for all your patients, for some of them, you might be able to open up time for more of them, right?
Yeah.
I didn't talk at all about shortages in physicians, but we know that there is already a primary care shortage, and we expect as we have more of an aging population, as more people get insurance, as more people have chronic diseases, that's just going to blossom. So even for, you know, if you can shift some of the care to email, then maybe it'll open up space for people who don't have access to that care.
Yeah, because it makes sense when we've all just, like, you need a prescription for something and you know what it is and you just have to tell your doctor.
Right, right. And you know, I think about e-prescribing, that first patient, the fact that I can e-prescribe something is just, it's like magic, you know.
Yeah, she would have suffered all weekend.
Right, right. I remember as a resident writing out, patients would come in, I'd write out 10 prescriptions, and now we can do that within seconds. So technology has made medicine much more efficient in that way, but you're right. I mean, there are going to be groups of patients, which I think over time will change, but there
sure,
are going to be groups of patients that don't have access to the internet or mobile devices.
A few other quick questions. When you showed a graph of the, was it the percent of practices that have adapted?
Yeah.
There was a dip after 2006.
Yeah, that's
or people having a backlash to it?
I didn't put the error bars in. There wasn't a significant change. Yeah, it was just, that's kind of just the
when you
data.
Look at it, it's not
yeah.
actually that much.
Yeah.
That's true. So.
And, you know, we'll see what happens as this goes on. You know, I hope it'll start to increase, but we're still at a very low
right.
percentage. Yeah. But this was not a statistically significant dip. Yeah.
I have one last question, then. So this is anecdotal, but I wonder, when I was very young, I remember I woke up one morning and my parents said, oh my God, you have chicken pox. I had chicken pox all over me. But technically, I mean, my parents could tell, but they didn't know what to do. They didn't
right.
have any other kids. So they called my doctor, and I remember my doctor said, please don't come in because you will infect everyone in the waiting
right,
room.
Right,
so
right.
I'll just tell you by phone what to do.
Right.
And in hindsight, I don't know if that was unusual or if before the internet was thing that we all used. In your research, are there people who sort of tried to do this with phones, like let's say 20 years ago? Was there like a movement to
actually. I don't know. I mean, you're right. Like someone comes in with a...
He was like, don't bring her.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, I think about flu season, you know,
yeah.
and how I prefer patients not come in
right.
because they can infect the staff, they can infect the
right.
patients.
Right.
You know, we ask them to wear masks when they come in,
and
if they have those symptoms, nobody wants to wear a mask in the waiting room. That's probably very forward thinking.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't even think of that, but that's actually an interesting point of,
yeah.
You know, is it better to manage some things actually without having patients come in because of those risks?
Right.
Photographs are fascinating. So we didn't ask specifically about the use of photographs, but I've been to some presentations of really interesting use of photographs to provide virtual care. So a lot in dermatology. So rashes are, you know, rashes are one of those things where I can't really manage them over the phone. I have to look at it. But there are places that are using photographs to actually document things to help patients send that information without having to come into the office. There was a practice up at UCSF that wanted to kind of decrease the number of referrals they did to dermatologists. And so they had primary care physicians take photographs of moles. And that was the common thing that they were sending their patients for. Take a photograph of a mole, send it to the dermatologist, and the dermatologist could do a quick assessment, decide if they had to come in or if it's nothing to be worried about. So there's a lot, the technology is there, but whether we use it and how we use it is still kind of a question.
Yeah, I was going to ask, do you have any sense of what percentage of doctors have access to secure messaging, whether or not they're actually using it?
I have to get back to you on that. The data are changing quite a bit on electronic health records. The most recent data, I can probably look it up for you and get back to you on it, is from either 2010 or 2011, and a lot has changed even since then. But this national survey that this data are from asks about electronic medical records and specifically about components like secure messaging. So I haven't looked at it recently, though, to find out how many have the capacity to do it. So that's information I can get for you. Yeah.
So are we in some ways setting up a trap for ourselves in a sense that I'm going to start outsourcing our medical care to God knows where, which happened with things like manufacturing, you know, information technology, so is the healthcare next. And you know, there's a reverse trend in the information technology, so those are coming back because they proved to not work right and be vulnerable to security attacks and whatnot. So is this what might happen when we do this?
These companies I mentioned, I remember when we were researching about this, some of my colleagues had never kind of seen these companies, but you know, this is probably the examples that you're thinking of, right? And I was like watching television one day and I saw a commercial on, you know, for, oh, you're having a cough and cold, email, you know, log in and we can solve it for you for $25, you know. I actually think it probably won't go as far as what call centers have done and information technology has done. I think there's still this idea of trust between doctors and patients. I think it's very hard to say, yeah, I trust this person on the other end, even if they have the credentials. I trust their judgment. We did talk to a group that's actually trying to get doctors' offices to create these systems where they give the tech, they license out the technology, and your doctor's office could be the one that you communicate with when you have these things going on. It's still in very early phases of things, but I still think there is this idea of, you know, I have patients that come in for, like, you know, their annual checkup to check in, and to build that trust, to kind of know that they know who they're talking to on the other end. So I think it's possible, but I don't think it's, I personally don't think it's going to go to the point where you're kind of emailing someone across the world for medical advice. It's possible, but I
can be so tricky. I mean, even licensing, you know, different licenses to practice in one state versus another state.
Right.
Your license can be revoked in one state,
right,
but not in another. And, you know, depending for what your license was. You know,
right. And actually, that does come up with these companies, that some states' licenses mean you can't practice, you can't deliver care to someone who's in a different state. And that's on a statewide level. So there are states where, you know, I could have a license that state, but it doesn't mean I can give care to someone in Minnesota because of the state. But that I don't know exactly which state is what, but there's variation in the states.
So are there any kind of laws that govern companies like this or not?
It's really no. I mean, it's really the state level licensing laws and that really kind of govern who can do what where. So if your state does not allow you to deliver care, you can't do an email consultation through one of these sites with someone who is in a different state. But if your state does, then you can. And I could probably track down some information about state licensing laws about that. But each state is very different. And other people. So some of these organizations use nurse practitioners and physician assistants to do that stuff. That's also at a statewide level, kind of what level of care you can deliver.
My last question is about money. You know, back in the day, I guess maybe 20 years ago, when it was more or less standard in care, you went to the doctor, they billed you, they would bill your insurance company for $300, then the HMO came along and it became 100, and after some other changes, it's like now 35. We're going to go down to doing 15 or 200 emails a day. Are they going to reduce the payments to 20 cents per email?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. That is a huge, huge question of how do you actually pay for it? And, I think insurance companies are worried that you'll get billed for every little email that goes back and forth, which is not the way you really want to go. Fairview, which is one of the examples we used, charges a fee for that e-visit, and they've decided it's still in the fee for service. So you provide a service, you get a fee. Group Health and Kaiser, because they're paid for by a big, they get money per patient, they don't really have an incentive, their incentive is to be as efficient as possible. So I think, the question is how is payment going to change? We don't know. I think there are a number of different models. Maybe you can pay for the e-visits specifically if they meet special criteria, that kind of question. Or maybe you have a fee, you get paid a global fee, or maybe you get paid like one of these organizations, a fee for seeing patients, but also kind of a little bit of a fee on the side for taking care of all the other care that's given to those patients. So lots of big questions. We don't have all the answers, and we'll kind of see. I mean, still mentioned healthcare reform, but there's a lot of demonstrations out there right now to look at ways we can pay for healthcare that might actually address some of those issues. So lots of something called the patient-centered medical home is something where you get a fee for taking care of a group of patients. Something called accountable care organizations are another way that they're trying to change the way we pay for healthcare. So I think there's going to be a lot of changes. I just don't know which direction they'll be in.
Thank you.